The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is music and web entrepreneur Sean Landris, the CEO of Jumpstart, the largest online Jewish music site in the world. We'll also have a visit from our Mevinah on Jewish Ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, Israel correspondent Rabbi David Wilfon from Jerusalem, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom! This is a season when we have just completed celebrating Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day. Actually, in our community here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, we will have our Israel festival later today, but, you know, better late than never. Anyway, it's a good time to talk about the relationship between American Jews and Israel. To be more specific, it's a good time of year to look at the cultural similarities and differences between American Jews and Israeli Jews. I was trying to explain some of this to the kids in our Hebrew school the other day, on the actual afternoon of Yom HaAtzmaut last Tuesday, and frankly, I don't think I really captured it. Of course, there are many commonalities between America and Israel generally, and all the pro-Israel organizations like to highlight those. We are both democracies with a strong tradition of a free and vibrant press. We both encourage innovation and entrepreneurship in business. We both have freedom of religious expression and include women in all aspects of society and the professions, and so on. The same kind of similarities can be identified in the Jewish communities of Israel and America. We are all Jews, of course. We celebrate the same holidays, believe in one God, or at least argue with and question that same one God, and feel connected to Jews everywhere in the world. We share a common ancient history, the knowledge of historical persecution, and a common remembrance of the Holocaust. And both societies, America and Israel, are very proud of the existence of the State of Israel and seek its security. But the differences between our cultures are significant, too. Israel is a small country and an intense one. America is a huge country, and in spite of our perceptions in serious economic times like, you know, now, we are a much more relaxed place than Israel. Israeli kids grow up knowing they'll be in the army when they turn 18. Israeli parents know it, too, and they treat their children differently because of it. On the other hand, most American Jewish kids are busy thinking about which college they will go to, or try to get into, anyway. It's just not the same thing. In Israel, the army compels young people to grow up very fast, sometimes too fast. In America, especially for Jewish kids, there's a kind of extended adolescence that affects the way we perceive the world. The old joke for Jewish kids goes like this: when does your child become an adult? When he graduates from medical school. It's different in Israel. For Israeli kids, they become adults at 18, on the day they enter the army. Quite different. Israeli Jews, most of whom are secular, experience Judaism anyway as a fact of national life, an obvious and accepted part of their history, holidays, government function, language, even food. They may not pray much at all, and they don't associate their own personal Judaism, at least not the ones who aren't deeply religious, with even entering a synagogue. American Jews, most of whom are nominally religious, accent on the nominally, experience Judaism when they choose to, in specific doses, in either religious settings and synagogues, at life cycle events, or in cultural choices that include music and, of course, food. But it's not the same Jewish food as Israelis choose, usually. Both are ways to be Jewish, but they are not the same. Now, all of these differences between America and Israel may seem obvious, but for lots of non-Jews, and actually for lots of American Jews, they are not. In fact, one of the very poorly understood facts of contemporary Jewish life is the contrast between the culture of American Jews and the culture of Israeli Jews. We like to pretend we're the same, but we aren't. Now, there's both a danger and an advantage to this contrast. The danger is that we American Jews may not identify much with Israelis unless we make a conscious choice to go to Israel and explore the country and the people. When we do, we find there are many things we love about Israel. And, of course, there are still many things we prefer about America. We aren't Israelis, no matter how Jewish we may be, unless we move there. And Israelis aren't American Jews, no matter how much they may enjoy our culture or our Jewish expressions here in the States. But, of course, we are all Jews. And ultimately, that's the real source of our strength as a people. A people rooted in the Torah, committed to God, and connected especially to a small sliver of land between the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea, between the Lebanon Mountains and the Sinai Desert. There is a joint Israeli-American program that helps build the relationship on both sides, and its successes and limitations illustrate this difference. In many communities, ours for example, there is an Israeli who works in the area to build knowledge of Israel and a closer relationship between the Jewish community here and in Israel. That person is called a shaliach, literally a messenger or emissary, sent to bring a unique Israeli perspective and the excitement of this dynamic country's life to Jews and even non-Jews who live far from Israel. I have worked with three such shlichim and have found them to be outstanding people, wonderful representatives of Israel and its culture. Some of them have been prominently featured here on the Two Jewish Radio Show as regulars. They make it very attractive for us American Jews to try to connect to our Israeli brothers and sisters. I expect these differences between American and Israeli Jews will always exist, and I also believe that this is a natural feature of prominent Jewish communities in different parts of the world throughout history. But when we are able to reach across what could be gaps of understanding to connect to one another and learn from one another, well, we all benefit. In that spirit, I have a confession to make. Last week, as some of you noted, I mistakenly said we were celebrating the 61st anniversary of the State of Israel. Actually, a lot of you noted that mistake. In fact, it was the 62nd anniversary. Apparently, as I age, I start to forget these stubborn little facts. So, as a form of al-chait, an atonement and confession for my error, here's the wonderful Israeli song, Ein li eretz acheret, I have no other land, for the 62nd birthday of Israel last week, as sung by Karin Alal. Ein li eretz acheret, I have no other land until the end of my days, the beautiful country of Israel. Of course, some of us have two lands, our own America, and the lovely land of Eretz Yisrael. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be Sean Landris, a young entrepreneur with his own record label who created the largest Jewish music site on the web, Jumpstart. We'll meet this cutting-edge Jewish innovator, find out how he does it, right here on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Sean Landris. He is the co-founder of Jumpstart and the current CEO. He's described as an essential thinker in explaining the new Jewish spirituality and culture by The Forward, which named him to its Forward 50 of 2009. Okay, so what does that mean?
Well, I think what it means, and it was a great surprise to be named to the Forward 50 and an honor. I think what it means is that for the past few years, Joshua Avedon, a co-founder of Jumpstart, and I have been engaged in learning about and writing about and supporting the work of emerging spiritual communities and their leaders. These are the new synagogues and independent minyanim and other kinds of congregations that have sprung up in the last 10 years or so around the United States and indeed around the world. And they are reinventing congregational life and exploring what it means to create intentional communities of sacred purpose for new generations and a new century.
You know, I've been sort of following this and talking to various people who started some of these minyanim and some of the kind of, for want of a better term, kind of free-form congregations. But how many of them are there out there, really?
There are quite a few, actually. A couple of years ago, Synagogue 3000, where Joshua and I worked prior to spinning out Jumpstart, along with Machon Hadar, conducted a survey led by Stephen M. Cohen. We documented at that point that there were nearly 100 of these organizations around the United States, and the number continues to grow.
The whole concept of not fitting into the standard mold has led people to explore all kinds of kind of edgier approaches to Judaism. How does one guess, you know, pretend to be a prophet as opposed to a sociologist, how does one guess which of these are likely to be sort of successful in the longer term or evolve into something more than 28 people in somebody's living room?
Well, I think that 28 people in somebody's living room actually doesn't necessarily need to go away. That can be a long-term model if what the 28 people in a living room are getting out of the experience is meeting their needs and helping them grow as individuals and as members of a community. One of the important things about the new phenomenon is that these are spiritual communities that most actually are without walls, without buildings, without capital assets of any kind. More importantly, many of them are not interested in growing. They're interested in finding stability and continuing to serve the needs of their members, but they're not looking to scale up in the way that we would talk about other social entrepreneurial ventures, scaling up for impact across a community or across a social sector. I think what is the predictor of success for them, for long-term success, is if they have a system in place of real accountability and reciprocity for their members. Are they providing and their partners and their attendees, because so many of them are playing with the idea of membership itself? Are they providing a community of meaning? Are they providing support to people in times of joy and in times of sorrow and in times of need? Are they demanding a certain amount of accountability from the same people? Are they asking them to put their lives in a context that's bigger than themselves? We talk so often about this highly individualized society that we live in, and there's also an argument that everything has to be free. But one one of the most compelling ideas coming out of the emerging spiritual communities is that you can actually make demands of one another, and you can actually explore with people the meaning of being in a community within which participants and members are accountable to one another and to the larger community and society.
We'll continue to explore some of these issues with Sean Landris and what social entrepreneurship really is when we come back this morning on Too Jewish.
If your parents or other loved ones are in need of assisted living, consider making the choice that Dorothy Daniels' family made, Handmaker.
Living at Handmaker does make me feel very independent, like I was still in my house. The best part of it is I don't have to clean it.
Assisted living at Handmaker promotes an active and independent life. All needs are met, including weekly housekeeping and linen service, transportation to doctor's appointments, restaurants, banks, and shopping. And living at Handmaker is fun.
Every 2 weeks, there is a man who comes with a saxophone, and we dance, and I love that because I love to dance.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites and cozy studios with patios and balconies.
I would recommend Handmaker to anyone because I feel very safe and secure here. The people that work here are very nice, considerate, and that means a lot.
For a tour and consultation, call 322-7035 or visit their website at handmaker.org.
Looking for a unique dining experience with menu selections made from scratch from the freshest ingredients? The Beeline, located at 621 North 4th Avenue, sets a new precedent with high-quality food and beverages in a counter-service setting. This blend has earned the Beeline the Best Casual Dining Award from Tucson Weekly 5 times. From their perfectly spiced mahi fish tacos to their popular pasta dishes featuring vodka, pesto, or traditional Italian red sauce, you are sure to find something perfect for your taste. Try their scrumptious dessert selection, carefully prepared from scratch by their talented pastry chef. Enjoy wines by the glass or bottle, microbrew, craft beers are on tap. The Beeline, 621 North 4th Avenue. Stop by or call 882-7575. Visit their retail location, Time Market on University Boulevard near 4th Ave, with a great selection of over 300 different wines and 100 beers and gourmet foods to go. Call 882-7575 for the Beeline and Time Market. Unique casual dining experiences. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, T-O-O. You can also get CDs of all past and present shows through the website, downloading us from there, or going to the Apple iTunes Store and getting the popular Two Jewish podcasts. This April has been a gorgeous month. If you don't like a mild spring, there's something wrong with you, which should put everybody into an upbeat mood. In that spirit, here's a delightful song from the Sephardic Jews recorded by the group The Voice of the Turtle. It's actually an 18th birthday song, a tradition among Jews in Spain, Portugal, Morocco, and elsewhere. 18 años tengo. Voice of the Turtle singing a Sephardic song for an 18th birthday. We welcome our special correspondent, Rabbi David Wilfond, speaking to us from Jerusalem. Good morning, Gingy.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
Doing well. So we're in the period of the counting of the Omer between Pesach and Shavuot.
So let me tell you about the Omer here in Israel. It's a very special time. The Omer is kind of a somber time. This is the time when we have Yom HaShoah and Yom HaZikaron. Those fit right into the Omer time. It's a time of semi-mourning.
So Yom HaShoah, of course, Holocaust Remembrance Day, Yom HaZikaron, the holiday in which you remember fallen Israeli soldiers of past wars.
Right. It's 20,200 soldiers. They just printed the number recently in the newspaper. It basically means it touches every family. So this is sort of a mourning time in between the joy of the freedom of Passover. It's preparing ourselves for that sober but also joyous time of receiving the Torah, Shavuot. So I want to give you a Hasidic interpretation of what's going on. We talk about Sfirot HaOmer as being the Hebrew lispor, to count the Omer. But in Hasidut, in the Hasidic tradition, they talk about the Sfirot, the 10 special elements of God, known as the Sfirot. And what they do is they say there are 7 that are part of this world and 3 part of a supernal, a higher world. And that we're actually going through 7 weeks, 7 combinations. So that each day there is a tikkun, a correction of these Sfirot, of these different qualities. And so there's a meditation for each day. And so through these meditations, we rise to this 50th layer or level, which is Shavuot, the actual receiving of Torah. So in this period, the biggest day is Lag BaOmer. And Lag BaOmer is, we play by different rules. All this mourning stuff ends. You can't get married during the Omer in Israel. No weddings are done except on Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer. And on this day, it's huge celebrations. And many people, this is what I want to talk about, many people go to Mount Meron. It's a huge pilgrimage site. It's the largest mountain in the Galilee, right across from Tzfat. At the bottom of the mountain, there is this tomb for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rashbi, he's called, the author of the Zohar. And everybody tries to get there.
I've been to Mount Meron. It's an extraordinary place. Maybe next week you could tell us a little bit more about that as we get close to Lag BaOmer. Thanks, Gingy. We'll talk next week. We welcome our Mavina, our expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, I know we all did something that we just don't really love doing, which is, you know, pay taxes. I do know some people who feel really proud to pay taxes because they feel like they're supporting freedom or their ability to live in America. But, you know, most of us wish we paid less or wish we didn't pay at all.
Well, it's funny. I had a friend once when I was practicing law who said to me about taxes, you know, I kind of make the government an offer and wait for them to counter. But for most of us, you know,
and then just pray they don't, actually.
It's an obligation that we have as being members of this beautiful community we call the United States of America. And it's interesting because when you look at, once again, the framework always of America is the sense we feel that we're entitled to certain things in this country, certainly. We're entitled to a police and a fire, you know, kind of safety system. We're entitled to roads and networks. We're entitled to communication systems, you know, that the government provides, healthcare now even more than ever. And of course, those things have, we're entitled to a military, but those things have to come from, obviously, you know, all of us. If we want those things, we all have to contribute. It is our responsibility. And the government tells us that, and it assesses taxes, and then it applies them based on, you know, the laws and that Congress enacts and locally that states enact and budgets provide for. But, you know, you look at the Jewish piece of this. I mean, can you imagine if there was only one network collecting all of the Jewish dollars and making determinations from an organizational standpoint only as to where those dollars would go, what would the reaction be? You probably have a microcosm of that within your own synagogue where, you know, there are funds collected for certain things and then committees or board members together make decisions as to how those funds are utilized and distributed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and obviously clergy staff are involved in deciding those things. It's,
of course.
That's why they're there.
But on a one-by-one basis, congregants are not generally allowed to say, I want my check for $100 to go, unless they make it to a specific fund.
Or unless it's $100,000.
Right. Well, of course, if the numbers do speak. But in general, when you pay your congregational dues, for
you don't get to say,
I only want $500 to go to Rabbi Kohan's new car fund, or something as glorious
as that.
It
really is a splendid idea.
So I guess one of the things I'd like to just kind of throw out to, you know, to you and the listeners is also this question of, you know, what should be our ability to determine when we make a contribution, where it goes to in the Jewish world? Should it be different than the way it is now? I can say from just looking at the historical changes in Jewish philanthropy that donor-designated funds, donor-designated contributions are becoming much more popular than they were even 5 years ago. That concept was a newbie 5 years ago, and now it's pretty standard.
Well, I think it's true. People like to be able to control that. Let's talk some more about the ways in which people use their donations to focus on their values in charitable organizations. Thanks, Amy. We'll talk next week.
Okay.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the Old Jewish Joke of the Week. We speak weekly with the outstanding chef, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant in the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Isn't it a beautiful spring?
It is an absolutely gorgeous spring. We have been enjoying it out on the patio at J Bar every single day.
And I'll bet there are special tastes besides all the special flowers of spring.
Well, it's springtime, and so we've got all the spring items. We've got great tacos made with wild halibut, beautiful beets that were roasted and tossed with a sweet pea and ginger vinaigrette, and Arizona pink grapefruit. We've got catfish done in pecans with an orange sauce. Great stuff at J Bar right now. All new menus, too.
It makes me, you know, unbelievably hungry. What's the best way for people to call you?
Give me a call at the restaurant, 615-6100. Go to our website, janos.com. You can make reservations right from our website.
www.janos.com. The best way to spend the spring here in Tucson.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking about Poland last week in the aftermath of the tragic plane crash that killed the Polish president and so much of their, you know, glittering leadership.
Right.
You mentioned something north of the Balkans, or in the Balkans as well. No plane crash is an accident.
No death is ever natural. That's true.
But right.
First of all, I have to correct myself. Something I said last week, which was that Poland was the most populous or second most populous country in the European Union, way off. It's like number 5, 6, whatever. Germany has more than twice as many people as Poland, particularly now that it's reunited. And also France, UK, Italy, and Spain all have more people. I think I was a victim, after living in Europe for so many years, of European fears about the opening to the East. They always talked about being swamped by cheap Eastern labor and how Poland had a much bigger labor market than any country in Western Europe and how all of Europe would be swimming in Polish laborers. Well, hard to imagine that, considering that many Western European countries are much larger and have a higher unemployment rate than Poland. But it goes to show some of the paranoia about the former communist countries. And, you know, the Warsaw Pact had its headquarters in Poland, obviously right near the Warsaw airport. And in one of the great ironies of post-Cold War history, that series of buildings is used for the annual conference that reviews implementation of human rights accords for all the countries that belong to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is a growing list of countries that now stands at 55 or 60. But this place that was once used to plan war games against with a design to bury the West is now used to review implementation of commitments that countries of the former Eastern Bloc have made to become more Western in terms of guaranteeing their citizens basic freedoms and human rights. So it's full of ironies. What's probably of greater interest to our listeners is Poland's kind of ambivalent relationship with its Jewish community, and it's always been ambivalent. Poland seems to like Jews best when they're gone. But, of course, there are many individual exceptions. During the Middle Ages, Poland invited Jews in when they were being kicked out of other places in Europe, which is the origin of a very large Jewish population, which grew and grew and grew until at one point, right before the Holocaust, Warsaw itself was about 35% Jewish. But over the long period of Jewish settlement in Poland, most Jews lived in the countryside. Their contact with Polish non-Jews was largely that of either tax collectors for the nobles, which didn't endear them to the local population,
didn't make them
or
popular.
Innkeepers who sold the locals booze at night. The locals got drunk, bought too much on credit, and ended up owing way more money than they thought they did to the Jews. So there were several sources of popular anti-Semitism over and above the fact that Poland is a deeply traditional conservative Catholic country with very close ties to the Vatican. And it looks like we better continue this next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. A Hebrew school teacher is observing her classroom of young children while they draw. She walks around to see each child's work. She gets to one little girl who is working diligently and asks her what she's drawing. The girl replies, "I'm drawing God." Teacher pauses and says, "But nobody knows what God looks like." Without missing a beat or looking up from her drawing, the girl replies, "They will in a minute." In contravention of the Second Commandment, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. You know, I think they're getting gentler, those jokes. We now welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. I wanted to start a whole series of stories. They're going to start off with a bunch of Chelm stories, the classic Jewish fool stories, where it's not just a fool in the story, but a whole town of fools, Chelm. And then I'll segue over the weeks into the flip side, some stories of being clever. But to start off with this little Chelm story. Once upon a time, a traveler was making his way through the back roads of Poland, and this was many, many years ago. And as he went, he lost his path, and he ended up finding his way towards the town of Chelm, though he didn't know it. Now, at this time, Chelm had just been gifted with lights, street lights that were gas-powered, of course. And as he came into the center of Chelm, as the light grew dim around him, he saw a man digging in the snow underneath one of these gas lights. And he walked up to the man and he said, "Excuse me, sir, but what are you looking for?" And the man looked up to the traveler and said, I lost my keys." And the traveler said, "Really? You lost them around here?" And the man said, No. I lost them a few blocks away down by the synagogue." And the traveler was a bit perplexed, and he said, "Then why is it that you're looking for them here?" And the man from Chelm, he stood up and he brushed the snow off of his coat, and he looked at that traveler as if he was a fool, and he said, "Don't you see? The light here is just so much better." And that was when the traveler knew he had come to a rather special place.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Emor, which includes passages that celebrate all the festivals of the Jewish year. Last week's double Torah portion of Achrimot Kedoshim focused on the holiness of truly ethical conduct. In Emor, we move to the ways that rituals create holiness in our lives, in particular by setting aside times and seasons for sacredness, and then dedicating these to God. In a conservative or Orthodox congregation, Emor is one of the most frequently read portions because it is chanted both when it falls in the normal reading cycle and again on each of the festivals it describes. That is, we read Emor this week, but also on each of the various festivals, from Sukkot in the fall to Pesach in the spring. In most areas of our lives, those things that happen rarely are considered to be more important. Graduation, weddings, vacations. But paradoxically, in Jewish tradition, those rituals which are observed more frequently are actually considered to be superior in holiness to those which we do less. The more you do something, or read something ritually, by the way, the holier it is. That is, the things you do the most are the most important in Judaism, or should be. Your actions should reflect your values. You should spend your time doing what matters and creates holiness. Which means that the process of remembering and celebrating the festivals, particularly the most frequent festival of all, the Sabbath, is especially important. For when you connect to these emblems of our religious tradition, when you embrace the rituals and special celebrations, you come to own that which can be holy in your own lives. And you learn that you can do it daily, or at least weekly, through the magnificent creation of Shabbat, the Sabbath. On this week of Parshat Emor, which focuses on sacred times and seasons, may we each find a way to embrace holiness in a way that makes it a habit, a regular part of our daily lives. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and find out from our guest, entrepreneur Sean Landris, just how to start a record label and a huge online Jewish music site, and who the most interesting Jewish musicians are to work with these days. All that when we come back on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In the interests of avoiding a disruption of his grandson's bar mitzvah, Judge Richard Goldstone, author of the infamous Goldstone Report on the 2009 Gaza War, said last week he would not attend the family simcha next month at a Johannesburg synagogue. In case Goldstone has any second thoughts, however, a leading South African Jewish group announced it is ready to protest at the bar mitzvah should he show up. "We'll exercise our constitutional right to protest," the chairman of the South African Zionist Federation, Avram Kringel, said on Monday. Goldstone, a respected Jewish jurist from South Africa, has been persona non grata in the pro-Israel community ever since the release of his UN report on the Gaza War, which found Israel committed war crimes in its three-week war with Hamas in Gaza in 2009. Pro-Israel groups have roundly condemned the report as dangerously one-sided, and it has helped fuel international condemnation of Israel and made his name anathema to many active Jews. Following negotiations between the Zionist Federation and Beis Medrash HaGadol, the synagogue hosting his grandson's bar mitzvah, Goldstone said last week, "In the interests of my grandson, I've decided not to attend the ceremony at the synagogue." The South African Zionist Federation head Kringel stressed that Goldstone was not barred from the bar mitzvah, but he would not be welcomed if he chose to attend, whatever that means. "We understand there's a bar mitzvah boy involved," Kringel said. "We're very sensitive to the issues. At this stage, there's nothing further to say." That'd be the first time in Jewish history anybody ever said that. Anyway, his position prompted a torrent of responses from around the Jewish world. Many defended Goldstone's right to attend the bar mitzvah, even as they criticized his report on the Gaza War. For example, Congressman Gary Ackerman of New York, chairman of the House of Representatives Middle East Subcommittee, wrote that he was appalled and utterly disgusted by reports that Judge Goldstone will not be able to attend the bar mitzvah's grandson due to protest threats by Jewish groups in South Africa. He described himself as an unapologetic critic of the Goldstone Report and of Judge Richard Goldstone's badly warped perspective on Israel's right to defend itself. But he went on to say there was absolutely no justification or excuse for carrying legitimate opposition and criticism of Judge Goldstone's wretched professional work into the halls of his family's synagogue, much less the celebration of a 13-year-old Jewish boy's ritual acceptance of responsible membership in the Jewish community. Rabbi Joel Oseran, a former guest of Too Jewish, speaking on behalf of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, expressed dismay at the deal struck by the leadership of South Africa's Jewish community. While we stand with Israel in disputing some of the findings of the Goldstone Commission's report, Judaism teaches that judgment and forgiveness are not ours to withhold or to give. Indeed, a little hard to understand messing up a kid's bar mitzvah because his grandfather conducted a report into Israel's war in Gaza. Participation in Taglit Birthright Israel trips this summer has doubled since last summer. 21,000 young Jews will take the free 10-day trip to Israel this summer. Thousands are on waiting list. This summer is the 10th anniversary of this remarkable Jewish educational project. We set a goal for ourselves within the next 7 to 10 years, half of Jewish youth living in the diaspora will visit Israel through our program, said Gidi Mark, the CEO of Taglit Birthright Israel. They will become alumni who represent the foremost strategic asset of the State of Israel. The number of participants of the summer season of our 10th year is testimony to our ability to achieve our goals. In part, they've got more money to spend this year with the recovery of the stock market. More than 250,000 Jews aged 18 to 26 from over 50 countries have traveled to Israel with Birthright. The American Jewish World Service has joined other human rights groups criticizing the Obama administration for not exacting consequences on Sudan for bad elections. The White House said last week that political rights and freedoms were circumscribed throughout the electoral process in Sudan. There were reports of intimidation and threats of violence in South Sudan, ongoing conflict in Darfur, and so on. But the White House said it regretted the problems and added that it remains committed to helping implement the remainder of a comprehensive peace agreement to culminate in a referendum next year on independence. Human rights groups depicted the White House statement as ineffectual, noting earlier pledges President Obama made to hold the president of Sudan accountable should he not abide by the terms of the peace agreement, as indeed he has not. Another former Too Jewish guest, American Jewish World Service President Ruth Messenger, said the administration must demonstrate that peace in Sudan is a priority worthy of the continued personal attention of the president, vice president, and secretary of state. They are clearly not doing that. And three national Jewish groups have urged Arizona's governor to veto a bill that will force local authorities to enforce federal immigration law. If passed, the bill would make state and local law enforcement officers' jobs nearly impossible, said the letter sent from the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, the American Jewish Committee, and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs to Governor Jan Brewer of Arizona. It would cause hardship to countless Arizona residents who, if this law is passed, will live under a cloud of suspicion and fear. The legislation becomes law unless Brewer vetoes it in the next 5 days. It will require police to ask suspects of being in the country illegally to produce documents. It would also ban soliciting work from people on sidewalks, which would stop a great deal of labor in the Southwest. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Sean Landris. He was named at the 2009 Forward 50. He's the co-founder of Jumpstart and the CEO. He's described there as an essential thinker explaining the new Jewish spirituality and culture. Sean has had extensive experience in academic and nonprofit leadership, peer network development, and grant management. He's been involved with projects funded by the U.S. State Department, the British government, worked as an intern for Vice President Al Gore's Reinventing Government initiative in his White House days, and has sort of been seen as a rising young leader in the American Jewish community. Sean, tell us what social entrepreneurship is.
The best way to describe it is, if I can borrow from a story told by one of the leaders in the general social entrepreneurship movement, Bill Drayton, who created Ashoka back in the early 1980s, and it supports social entrepreneurs around the world. So what Bill Drayton thinks of as a social entrepreneur is best described by the following. If you remember the old story, if you give a person a fish, that person will eat for a day, and if you teach a person to fish, that person will eat for a lifetime. well, what a social entrepreneur would want to do is actually change the fishing industry itself. So social entrepreneurship really involves the idea that you look at a problem, a social problem or a social opportunity that is society-wide or community-wide, and you think of responses to that problem or opportunity that are systemic, that are intended to create long-lasting change that is actually systemic change, and then implement whatever steps are needed in order to achieve that change, whether they be grant-based or income-based or time-based, all the tools that are available to making a systemic change in society are used by social entrepreneurs, and in general, they are distinguished from managers who are interested in managing problems. And this is not to say that social entrepreneurs or managers, the one is better than the other. In fact, what really generally happens in a healthy system is that social entrepreneurs identify a problem or an opportunity, they devise a response to it, they get the systems, they get their vehicle for responding to it up and running, and then they find the best possible managers who can actually sustain it and scale it and ensure that the transformation is both widespread and long-lasting.
You and Joshua Avedon, your partner in founding Jumpstart, worked for Synagogue 3000, which was originally, of course, Synagogue 2000 before we got to 2000. Rabbi Larry Hoffman, another former guest of Two Jewish's kind of dream of transforming synagogues into more dynamic places. Do you think those efforts have borne fruit in the general sense? Do you think synagogues have begun to transform?
I think they really have, and I think that Synagogue 2000 and Synagogue 3000 are continuing to make a really important difference in that regard. And they are continuing to do their work alongside the work and impact of organizations like the Experiment in Congregational Education, ECE, and STAR, Synagogues Transformation and Renewal. There really was a whole series of efforts to transform the American synagogue. And more than anything, I think what they have accomplished is that they have raised the awareness of leaders in American synagogues, both spiritual leaders and professional leaders, as well as lay leaders, about the need to be reflective and the need to look forward and the need to the opportunity to imagine what their community could look like as opposed to what it looks like now. I don't think necessarily that we have exhausted the range of solutions, practical implementations, to the challenges that face American synagogues. But I do think that far more than say 10 or 15 years ago, leaders in American congregations are aware of the challenges that they face and feel a little bit more empowered to address them than perhaps they did in the past.
You know, I've had long conversations with Danny Friedlander and Rabbi Arik Yaffe about what this virtual congregation is going to become. You know, just speaking very anecdotally as a congregational rabbi, I send out a weekly email. We podcast our classes. My associate rabbi, he writes a regular blog. I was forced to go on Facebook by my congregants who took up a collection. Where does all this... Is the congregation now both more immediately available electronically and less available in person for people?
I don't think you can ever replace the face-to-face interaction that comes with being a part of a congregation. I know that there are efforts to create online Jewish communities. There are a number of synagogues in Second Life, which is a virtual online community. I think, in fact, there are so many. There are enough synagogues in Second Life that you can have the one that you virtually go to and the one that you virtually do not go to.
God, that's like an old joke. Just virtually moved into contemporary life.
Exactly. Exactly. Where wouldn't you be caught dead in cyberspace?
Of course, in cyberspace.
But I think that what the virtualization of connections makes possible, whether it's broadcast, one-way broadcast technologies like like email newsletters, right, which go one way. They go from one to many.
Right, they're not
or two-way communication tools like Facebook and Twitter and other social media, where you're actually not only sending out, but you're also getting feedback in response, or indeed three-way communication, where you're actually facilitating interactions among members of the community and giving them tools to deepen their relationships with one another. I think all of those technologies are combining to both broaden and deepen the way that congregations can be involved in the lives of their members and attendees. And I think the online communities do make an extraordinary difference for people who simply can't get to a physical synagogue for one reason or another. I'll give you two examples that I'm familiar with, one in the United States and one actually in Spain. In the United States, the Jewish Television Network actually arranged to broadcast Kol Nidre live over the Internet. That made it possible for people recovering from surgery, for shut-ins, for people with disabilities, people who are, for whatever reason, unable to get to a congregation to participate in the Kol Nidre experience. And it was extraordinary for them. In Spain, there's a community called La Jabura, which actually uses Skype and the telephone to hold Kabbalat Shabbat services for people who are scattered all over Spain and Spanish-speaking communities and would be unable to put a minyan together in person, but can come together as a very, very rich community over the Internet and over the telephone, and they do Torah study together and they celebrate holidays together. It's a really, really powerful model.
I'm fascinated by the extraordinary opportunities you describe, some of the virtual world, and the fact that there are a lot of people who are very content to come to services and spend the entire time looking at their iPhones and Blackberries. How much of this really takes us away from connectedness?
Those people obviously haven't been to ICAR, which is my community here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's possible to be a part of ICAR and be distracted by an iPhone or a BlackBerry in the middle of the services and learning that the ICAR community has developed. It's an extraordinary place that has really changed what it means to be accountable and to be part of something bigger than oneself for so many people in their 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s now. It's a really multi-generational experiment that has become a very powerful community, and I'm speaking personally. And what I think ICAR does, and this is I think emblematic of what has happened at other communities, is actually giving people tools to bring the synagogue or congregational experience into daily life, and to bring daily life into the synagogue or congregational experience. We don't check who we are at the door. We don't make a division between Shabbat and every other day of the week. When we come to Shabbat, we bring our whole selves, and the learning and the interactions really, really celebrate and acknowledge that. And when we talk about Torah, when we talk about God, when we talk about ethics and social justice and the moral imperatives that exist, we don't leave those at the synagogue door either. We think about how to incorporate them in our daily lives and create groups. ICAR is pioneering something called the Minyan Tzedek process, which is a terrific project to combine social justice priorities with the small group movement that has really taken both Jewish and Christian congregations by storm over the last 15 years. So Minyanei Tzedek are these small groups that are building community within themselves and also focusing on important social justice concerns like food justice or immigration reform, education reform. And that actually gives people a direct link from what happens in the prayer service to the Beit Midrash, to the learning hall, to our lives during the week and around the year.
Sean, a question I should have asked earlier. Tell me what Jumpstart does.
Jumpstart is an incubator, catalyst, think tank, and advocate for what we call sustainable Jewish innovation. We are trying to do our part to build the creative capacity of the Jewish community for the 21st century. You know, we've spent a lot of time now talking about emerging spiritual communities, but what's extraordinary is that there are spiritual communities, learning communities, social justice communities, communities in the arts and culture, all around the country now, all around the world, that are just transforming what it means to be part of Jewish life in the 21st century. And Jumpstart is committed to developing, strengthening, and learning from those organizations and communities, and using what we learn to help transform the broader Jewish community and the world around us.
I want to thank Sean Landris for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The website is jewishjumpstart.org, just like you would think, Jewish, J-U-M-P-S-T-A-R-T.org. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Binyamin Cohen, author of the fascinating and fun book, My Jesus Year, A Rabbi's Son Wanders the Bible Belt in Search of His Own Faith. Our play out this morning on Too Jewish comes from the Jews of Yemen, Neve Midbar, a song called Oasis. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good spring week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
מנשות המדבר נבעתי בשירת נשמות